Okay, first of all, I'd like to also extend my welcome to everyone here. It's great to be here. And I'd like to actually, as a first note, just thank a few people. Number one on the list is, of course, Nigel, for having actually started the ball rolling on this program as a whole. He also deserves a lot of credit for actually organizing this particular conference. When I say the members of the organizing committee of this meeting, I don't really count myself as part of that. So I'm not thanking myself, in case you're wondering. And finally, of course, the Newton Institute and his staff. So I'd just like to say thank you right at the beginning to everyone who's had a part in organizing this. Second, I wanted to make a comment that's similar to what Nigel said about the two kinds of talks that will be given here. I'll let you read this for a moment. And this is just to say to the students, please don't do that, okay? So what I will do is to give a very general talk. It will be mostly oriented toward getting us to basically on the same page in terms of some fundamentals of stellar magnetic activity. But most of the talk will actually be a series of questions. So I won't presume to answer them. I'll expect you to answer them through the next week and a half, almost 2 weeks. So in the spirit of this introduction, I think it's useful to just make a few comments. The subject that we're about to embark on is one of the oldest in astronomy. And if you go back to the Chinese records, of course, the Chinese were awfully fascinated by sunspots. They knew about them. They kept track of them. They knew about the correlation of sunspot activity and auroral activity. They understood about magnetic fields in general. They, of course, knew about compasses. And you can go into the records, for example, of Middle Ages and find drawings such as this, which is an interesting comment about relating reality. So here's an image of the sun with an imperfection to one's notion of what there's actually up there, sort of a way of abstracting an imperfection that one sees in something that should have been perfect. And so, of course, the image, the drawing, is perfect. It's interesting to note that the idea that these imperfections are due to magnetic fields was, in terms of this history, really very late in coming. It only happened at the beginning of the last century. And as far as stars are concerned, there's almost 50 years that separated the discovery of magnetic fields using the Zeeman effect by Hale to when Babcock finally discovered, measured magnetic fields on 78 Virginis. It's an amazingly long period, and it tells you something about the difficulty of these observations. So really quite a challenge. So let's start with some common ground. Here's a sunspot in detail, and the thing that I want to emphasize for present purposes is the structure, and the fact that you see convection cells, you see a sunspot with its own substructure, very intricate. Features, magnetic features, seem to be related to the convection pattern. Here's a pore, for example. And so the key question, obviously, from this picture, you immediately get the sense that we ought to think about connecting the convecting pattern that we see at the surface with these structures. And one of the questions that I'll get back to is, well, what is that connection? There are also the great regularities that were discovered in the 1800s. For example, the fact that the emergence of these sunspots is periodic in time. That period is of the order of 11 years. That emergence is geometrically regular. You see that here. The butterfly diagram that as time progresses from left to right, that the emergence starts of spots starts at high latitudes and then descends down to the equator of the sun, the so-called butterfly diagram. The fact is irregularity also in the polarity of the fields, that the polarity switches, positive, negative, next cycle the other way around. And finally, that if one looks at detail, that is, if you take this kind of picture, which shows the number of sunspots as a function of time, and you see here the 11-year cycle, if you look in detail at timescales of the order of a month, that you actually begin to see the rotational modulation that's due to these spots. The fact that the spots, the larger spots, typically have lifetimes that are longer than the rotation period, and therefore modulate the solar constant. You can actually detect them. Now, if you go to stars, you see similar things. And the only difference here is that stars can do these things at extremum. So, for example, rotational modulation. Here is a dwarf star, an M dwarf star, UI Draconis. What you're seeing here is the light curve as a function of time. And the thing to notice here, first of all, is that the modulation here occurs on days as opposed to weeks. So this is a rapidly rotating star. And also, the amplitude of the modulation is dramatically larger. In the case of the sun, the modulation, the rotational modulation is of the order of one part in 100,000. Whereas in the case of these stars, the modulation can be of the order of 10%. Hugely different. If you look at the picture that I showed you, so the modulation of the sunspot number on the surface, and you look at other ways of looking at activity of the sun, for example, in X-rays, what you find is that the magnetic activity, this surely is magnetic activity, there's spots, is also related to other kinds of activity indicators. For example, in X-rays, the red dots here indicate observations taken from Yoko of the sun, and the dots from left, from top to bottom, correspond to the pictures, the images here that you see from left to right. So at the sunspot maximum, you see a bright X-ray corona, and near minimum, the sun becomes fairly dark. So it's pretty clear there is some relationship. One could have constructed this kind of picture, the sense that the outer corona of the sun knows about the presence of solar magnetic fields much earlier. In fact, your image is taken with a coronagraph. This happens to be a coronagraph in space, but you can do similar sort of things from the ground, ground-based coronagraphs, where again what you see is here the blue dots, they correspond again from left to right to the blue dots that you see on the light curve here. And again, one sees changes in the appearance of the corona as the sunspot cycle comes and goes. The changes in the visible corona, so what you're seeing here is Thompson scattered photons from the visible surface of the sun being scattered by hot electrons in the outer corona of the sun, the changes here are not as, they don't hit you in the eye as much as the X-ray images do. Here it's clear that there is a correlation between activity of the X-ray variety and activity of the magnetic variety. And what about stars? Well, the systematic survey of stars started now almost 25 years ago at the launch of the Einstein Observatory. And here's a picture, for example, of the Hyades taken with the imaging proportional counter on Einstein. And here's a picture by the Chandra Observatory, which is in orbit now, taking data as we speak, of another cluster, NGC 3603. And of course, the dramatic difference between the image on the left and the image on the right is, number one, the sensitivity, and number two, the spatial or angular resolution of the pictures. We can now look at clusters and see in detail the individual stars glow. And one of the lessons of these observations is that virtually all stars are X-ray sources. And in fact, one can argue that those that are not seen may not be seen simply because of a sensitivity question, not because they're not intrinsic emitters. So I couldn't resist taking an early drawing from the Einstein survey that, on the basis of just a few, handful of data from the early days, around 1980, one was already able to say something about what classes of stars are X-ray emitters. First of all, stars on the main sequence, solar-type stars being down here, and as it goes back up here, the early-type stars, hot stars, supergiants, red giants, and white dwarfs. What you can't see here yet is what are called the dividing lines, the fact that, for example, for giants that are roughly redder than the sun, X-ray emission seems to disappear. It may be a question of sensitivity again, but instead what these stars do is they become active wind emitters. So they're still active, but active in a different way. Now, one of the neat things about stars, of course, is that you have knobs to turn. Take a star like the sun. You can ask, well, what does the sun look like if it were younger? Or what would the sun look like if it were rotating more quickly or less quickly? And to answer questions like that, you just go out into the cosmos, you look, and look at examples of stars that have these attributes. For example, they're just like the sun, except they're rotating more quickly. So, for example, if you look at the sun, stars like the sun, one of the discoveries was that the stellar luminosity seems to scale with rotation rate, and the scaling law, roughly speaking, it goes like the rotation frequency squared. And the coronal temperatures resemble solar coronal temperatures, although in detail things are different. And what I mean by that is this range of temperatures on the sun is an attribute of coronal plasma that's quiescent, say the quiet sun, which has temperatures more of the order of a few million degrees, to flares, where the temperatures can reach 100 million degrees. Whereas in stars, we have observed stars that have mean temperatures that are at the upper range of the solar range. So clearly, stars resemble the sun, but also in some sense are different. They can be more extreme. Now, there are other ways, other knobs that we can turn. For example, we can go to stars that are much more massive than the sun. What happens then? Well, one thing that happens, we know from solar structure theory, is that the surface convection zone disappears. So you might think, if you already have in mind, surface convection is responsible for, in part, for magnetic activity, perhaps magnetic fields turn off and you don't see X-rays. Well, that would be wrong. In fact, these stars are vigorous X-ray sources. They're very bright. They can be of the order of 100,000 times brighter than the sun, in fact, in X-rays. The difference is in the scaling. The X-ray luminosity for these stars seems to scale with the bolometric luminosity. It's an interesting fact because the total mass loss rate for these stars is also believed to scale with the bolometric luminosity. So perhaps there's a connection. Interesting enough, recently there's been evidence for some sort of plasma confinement on these stars. The question is, how do you confine plasma on these stars? It's very difficult to do because, in fact, the atmospheres are vigorously expanding and reach terminal speeds. The winds from these stars reach terminal speeds that are factors of 10 to 100 times larger than the terminal speed for the solar wind. Now, what about the very young stars? Well, in this case, the X-ray luminosity doesn't seem to scale with either the rotation rate or the bolometric luminosity. In fact, if you take the sun and just turn the clock backwards and go back to its young phase, that is, you look for stars in very young clusters that will become the sun on the main sequence, what you find is that this scaling that I talked about above, the scaling of the X-ray luminosity with the rotation frequency, in fact, goes away. And stellar astronomers talk about saturation of activity. And I'll get back to that a bit later on in this talk. And finally, I just want to note that the emission, which is certainly variable for both of these classes of stars, is really variable. It's highly intermittent for the young pre-main sequence stars. Sorry about that. Is the gentleman... Oh, he's not around. I have no idea how to get rid of this thing on top. Any hints? Does anybody in the audience know how to do that? Okay. We'll just have to put up with it. Okay, so the point that I want to make here is that I showed you field structuring at the surface, at the photospheric level. I showed you the sunspot and the pore and the convection cells. And what's interesting about that structuring, that is structuring at the visible level, is that translates to plasma structuring by magnetic fields above the surface as well. So the image that people had, for example, if you go back 30, 40 years of the solar corona, as something that's fundamentally a diffuse plasma structure, albeit very hot, is basically completely wrong. And if you look, for example, at these images taken with the TRACE telescope, you see that the plasma that's sitting above active regions is highly structured by the magnetic field. The heating is highly intermittent. And an interesting question is how this structure, in fact, connects to the structure down at the bottom. And this is the kind of question that missions in the future, for example, Solar B, will be looking at, in fact. Not only is the plasma highly structured, but it's highly dynamic. And I remember writing a paper, a review paper, many years ago, more than 25 years ago, that said, if you want to know whether the sun is variable, you pick your time scale, and you'll find something on the sun that varies on the time scale. And I think missions such as the TRACE mission have shown that that's really quite true. You pick the time scale, and you can find a movie that the TRACE folks have that shows variations on that time scale. Things happen all the time. This is not so the idea of modeling the solar corona is basically, for example, an ensemble of equilibrium structures. Is I think if you look at a movie like this one, somewhat dubious. So you question, the one of the questions is, what would you perturb? Yes, there's a question there.
What I've seen in this lower
okay, sorry. Okay, so what you're looking at here is also a sequence of images that are taken also by TRACE. Alan will tell us what line it is. Is it an iron line?
It's iron 10171.
Okay. So it's emission that's of the order of a million degrees, perhaps a little bit less. Okay.
700,000 degrees.
Right. Okay. So you're looking. So what you're looking at here is a combination of plasma that's been heated to that temperature and basically stays there for some short period, and or plasma that's been heated to much higher temperatures, say tens of millions of degrees, and is now cooling down. So what people used to call post-flare loops. And so what this is just a sequence that the TRACE folks have constructed based on single images such as this one.
Okay.
So those of you who like plasmas.
30 seconds.
What's the time scale?
30 seconds.
30 seconds. And just in case you think that the structuring is just something that's peculiar to magnetic fields on stars, you can go down the street, across the street, to the observatory and talk to the non-solar astronomers, and they'll tell you, well, you see structuring due to magnetic fields in just about any object that you care to look at in the universe, from pulsars and supernova remnants. Here's the Crab supernova remnant with its filamentary structure. And here you're seeing electrons that are radiating synchrotron emission. So these are highly accelerated relativistic electrons that are emitting. And here you see the magnetosphere of the pulsar. The pulsar sits right in the middle. And this image, this thing, is about a third of the size of the nebula. So if I took this and put it on top of the nebula, it would sit somewhere like that. And I can tell you from a direct experience, seeing folks who've been working on the magnetosphere of pulsars and having them see this picture for the first time, the total astonishment at what this looks like. I can assure you that no one predicted that the magnetosphere of the Crab pulsar would look like this. Of course, here you see plasma heating on a much more grandiose scale. This is plasma that surrounds a galaxy. And here you see jets coming from an active galactic nucleus. Again, structure. So the structure of magnetic fields appear everywhere. Now, if we summarize, I'm going to do this from a theorist's perspective, so the observers will have to forgive me for this perspective. The first point that I wanted to make is that here we are, some almost 50 years after the classic paper by Gene Parker, which was the first paper to show how you could construct a dynamo for the sun that actually had some plausibility. It wasn't a clockwork process of details in some abstract machine, but this is a dynamo that appealed to fundamental physical principles in a real object in the sun. And what's amazing about it is its longevity. There are not many ideas that start off that way and last for as long as they have. In fact, what's remarkable about this paper is that it's largely organized the community's thinking about the entire subject. So still today, you'll find lots of papers in the literature talking about alpha-omega dynamos. And you'll hear a discussion of what that means, I think, later on today. So, to me, what is remarkable, I will get back to this, is how many features of the fully nonlinear sun are actually captured by a model that's, in essence, just linear kinematic dynamo theory. So what is captured? Well, many of the things I showed you, the periodicity, the butterfly diagram, the Hale polarity law, all those you can extract from this linear theory. On the other hand, if you ask for first principles demonstration, by that I mean something that you go down the hall to your physics colleagues and say, I understand how this works on the basis of first principles, the answer is, we still don't have that. In fact, if you ask, are we certain exactly how the large-scale solar dynamo works, I think the answer is no, we're not certain. In fact, we're not even certain exactly where it's located. Is it distributed? Is it at or near the tachocline? Where is it? And this is, of course, a subject dear to the heart of folks who do here seismology, trying to understand exactly what the location of the dynamo is. The question of why you see the field structuring that I showed you right at the beginning of the talk. Well, the origin of that is also, I think, controversial. And I'll talk about that a bit. Is it a fast dynamo? Or is it the MHC turbulences acting on large-scale interior fields? Or maybe it's yet something else. I think one of the motivations behind this meeting is the assertion, it's nothing but an assertion, that the kinds of things that we've learned for the sun are in fact useful for other stars, especially what are called solar-type stars. That is, stars that have outer convection zones and are rotating. And a critical question that I'll get back to is, how do we know that this is really true? And how would we test that idea? Of course, the attraction, if this ansatz is correct, that is, that you can make this transition from the sun to the stars, is that these stars allow us to turn knobs on the theory, expose weaknesses in the theory, take the theory to extremes, and see whether or not it really works. So things like rotation rate, stellar mass, and stellar age, things I've already shown you. Now, I do want to make one aside about laboratory astrophysics, because this is a subject that I think does not come up very often in meetings such as this, and I think that as we go into the next 5 to 10 years, will become increasingly important. So I really feel it important to make some comments about this. So what am I talking about here? So laboratory astrophysics, traditionally, if you go back into your solar textbook, what you'll find people mean by that term is you measure fundamental physical properties. So, for example, nuclear cross-sections or reaction rates, oscillator strengths, F-values, opacities, equations of state, and such. And that, of course, is still going on, especially for stars that are a bit more peculiar than the sun. Within the last roughly decade, perhaps 20 years, other kinds of things have been going on. For example, in solar physics, we talk a lot about particle acceleration, and one critical question is, can we find laboratory examples of particle acceleration that validate ideas that are developed in the solar case? The same thing goes for plasma heating processes. Reconvection is today a very active field in the laboratory, and one classic question in the laboratory is, what is the evidence, in fact, for fast reconvection in the laboratory? And as best I know, in fact, there's only one experiment that's actually shown a hint of that, which is the experiment at Princeton, which shows a hint of a fast regime, but whether or not everybody believes it is still, I think, a bit open to question. And of course, a literally hot topic nowadays is, can you replicate the Medina rotational instability that goes back to Chandrasekhar and Belikov, that is the instability of accretion disks, magnetic accretion disks, can you recover this in the laboratory? Can one actually do this as a problem? And this is something I'm not going to talk about, but I think it would be fun to discuss, those of you that have interest in that. And that's highly relevant to discussions of exactly how very young stars, protostars, work, because disks are important in that context. Now, the new frontier, and the reason that I actually bring this topic up, is because you will see a gathering storm of simulations presented at meetings such as this. And I think it's a fair question for you, especially the students and postdocs, to ask those of us standing up here who do simulations of highly nonlinear systems, how do you know you've gotten the right answer? So there are two aspects of answering that. One is what computational physicists refer to as verification. That, I think, basically reduces to, have you solved the equations correctly, and do you have any bugs? As a more subtle question, which goes under the moniker of validation. What is validation? Validation is all about asking, how do you know that the nonlinear equations that you're solving are actually appropriate to the physical system that you're studying? And for us as astronomers, that's a very, very difficult question to answer because we can't do experiments. So fair demand one can have of the computational physicist, or computational astrophysicist, is to say, well, you think that, for example, your MHD code gives the correct answer. Well, if it does, let me give you a laboratory problem in which we know there are fluids that are turbulent, in which magnetic fields are present, and can you, in fact, replicate the behavior of the laboratory system? That process of taking laboratory problems and seeing whether astrophysics codes can, in fact, address the laboratory problems is a field that's really in its infancy, and I think something that's going to become more and more important, especially as we look to more and more complicated problems. So the key here to remember is that if you want to do direct numerical simulations, DNSs, the hope of ever doing a direct numerical simulation of an astrophysics problem is a dream. And I don't know whether it's a dream that will ever be realized. And it would be fun to discuss, those of you interested in that problem, whether there's any computer that can ever be conceived of, or for example, you're simulating as a direct numerical simulation, for example, the sun, or some reasonable portion of the sun, something that you can actually resolve. In contrast, you can certainly construct laboratory experiments where one can do direct numerical simulations. Of course, even the laboratory, for example, if you simulate liquid metals, you can't hope to realize today the fluid Reynolds numbers of, for example, liquid sodium, which is of the order of a million. You can't do that as yet. But we can certainly do magnetic Reynolds number. So what that means is that in the laboratory case, it's possible to make direct contact between the simulations and an actual physical experiment to an extent that you cannot do in astrophysics. So what I now want to do is talk a bit about puzzles. And I'm going to be selective. What that means is I'll mention the puzzles that I like. And if you like other puzzles, then you're welcome to talk about them. But I'm going to talk about the ones I like. And I'm going to talk about two different kinds of puzzles, things that relate to, if you like, the conceptual basis of the subject, then problems that are more specific, perhaps, to physical processes or specific stellar objects. So one question is a question that I actually talked about at the beginning, which is, let me just read it to you, why do simple models so well describe the large-scale magnetic field behavior? This is a point that I made earlier, that Parker's alpha-omega dynamo does so well. What's the issue here? Well, a couple of points. First of all, we know that the kinematic models really describe the system in the linear regime. So small amplitudes, infinitesimal amplitudes, and the solutions are exponential in time. We are absolutely certain that the actual physical system, if you look up at the sun, is not operating in that regime. It's operating in some sort of saturated, fully nonlinear regime. So you might ask, well, how, you know, what is the connection between these two? Now, it happens to be the case that many of the features of the nonlinear regime, that is, you look up at the sun, has features, they're captured by the linear study. And in fact, it doesn't take much. In fact, there are a number of people in this audience who've taken the simple linear system and modified it slightly, for example, introducing nonlinearities, for example, to understand back reactions making field on the field, on the fluid, allow you to, in fact, account for many of the things that are not accounted for in the simpler linear theory. So it looks like you can get a long way by just sticking with Parker and tuning in a bit. Now,
can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why do you imply that the nonlinear system? You seem to make.
Oh no, I didn't. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say nothing of the sort. All I said is, we know that the system that you look up there is nonlinear. And the reason we know it's nonlinear is because it doesn't show exponentially growing solutions. The magnetic field of the sun that isn't running away in amplitude.
Yeah, but you have polarity law, for example.
Right.
I mean, why should this be a nonlinear process? It's not clear to me.
Okay.
I mean,
hold on. Yes, yes, yes. Just patience.
I don't see why, you know.
I fully agree. So here's the question. So you're asking, why is this puzzling? Right? That's what you said. And my answer is, go to your local applied maths department and ask the applied mathematicians, give me your favorite nonlinear system. They'll hand you some nice equation. Say the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Okay? And you can then ask them, what are the odds for such a system, picked out at random, that the solutions to the fully nonlinear system bear any resemblance to the linear eigenfunctions? And you know the answer. The answer is they generally bear no resemblance at all. In fact, most nonlinear systems have no memory of the linear behavior. Okay? In fact, you would have to struggle to come up with a nonlinear system that does have this memory. So that is the puzzle, I think. The puzzle is that the sun happens to be in a state that it does remember what the linear behavior is like. And the question is, why is this so? And that's really what I'm asking.
You see, excuse me, but
yes.
I'm going to be short. Ideal polarity, you can understand it in some extent, being a toroidal structure that rise, and you will get naturally this plus and minus and minus and plus. But what would be the nonlinear process that behind it be if the distribution of such plus and minus were kind of erratic and difficult to predict? That, for me, will be the nonlinear part of the problem. But the actual rise of the toroidal structure to have this plus and minus orientation, this is nonlinear. It's just simple process.
Sure. I didn't say that every single piece of what's observed requires nonlinearities. What requires nonlinearities, number one, is the saturation. And number two is, you might ask about, for example, the field emergence itself, the latitude distribution, where does that come from? Okay, those things. No. I completely agree. It's not every single aspect that that one has to appeal to nonlinearities. Quite right. Anyway, so here's one possible answer, which is perhaps the nonlinear large-scale dynamo operates close to some marginal state. You know, it's close to a weakly nonlinear regime. Perhaps it does. And in that case, if it does, then one can actually show, if you look at model systems, that the nonlinear system does remember what the linear eigenfunctions are like. And in fact, if you look at low-order truncated models, for example, I saw Chris Jones in the back, Nigel, and others have, of course, worked on this and have shown exactly this, that knowing the linear eigenfunctions are very helpful in understanding the behavior of nonlinear systems as long as they're weakly nonlinear. But maybe that's completely wrong. Another question that I mentioned at the beginning has to do with this translation of what we know about the sun to the stars. So this is the question of, is the sun, in fact, a sensible template? So if you look at the phenomenology of that solar physicists talk about, field production, non-thermal heating of the corona that's related to the field emergence, acceleration of winds and particles, the first point to make is that the sun is really the only laboratory that we have for studying this in any detail. Other stars we largely see only as point sources. So if we want to make progress, in some sense, for stars that is, in some sense we should hope that this is true, that it is in fact a sensible template. Because if it isn't, we have a problem. Now it turns out that stars in fact show much of this phenomenology. That is, we know that magnetic fields are produced, we know that there are a coronae of solar-like stars that behave in many ways just like the solar corona. We know that these stars have winds and emit particles. In fact, there are beautiful radio observations of stars that show flares, for example, in the radio at the same time that one sees X-ray flares, very much like the case of the sun. Now, the problem is, of course, that if you look at stars in general, the luminosity, the mass, the age, the temperature, all the knobs that we have on stellar structure all can be varied over much wider ranges than I think the folks that originated these theories had ever thought of. That is, the theory for the solar magnetic field was not designed at the outset to explain the magnetic field behavior of all stars. It was designed in the first instance to just explain one star. And so what's remarkable is that, in fact, there's some hope even of extending it to other stars, except that I've already mentioned some peculiarities. For example, activity saturation, a point that I'll get back to in a moment. The fact that surface convection shuts off, and yet we still see magnetic what may be magnetic field-related plasma heating. The fact that core convection can start, and the question is, what does that do? The fact that some stars show polar spots, whereas on the sun, we'll never see spots at the poles. So there are differences. So another question that's related to this early one has to do with what, in fact, are the ingredients that are necessary to have what is generally called stellar activity. So the first question to ask is, well, are magnetic fields sufficient and necessary? Is it conceivable that I could have a stellar object that is active but yet doesn't have magnetic fields? What about the question of what are, in fact, the magnetically active objects? Well, we certainly know that late-type stars are. I just showed you earlier a picture of a pulsar, the Crab pulsar, that's most certainly active. We have examples close by of very active planets. Jupiter, for example, is a very active planet from the plasma point of view, and that wouldn't be the case if it weren't a magnetic object as well. And an obvious question is, how far can we go? What about, I'll get back to that a bit later, what about the stars that lie between Jupiter and the Sun, that are stars that are almost stars, that have just on the verge of nuclear burning? Do they have magnetic fields? Now, of the objects that are magnetically active, you can ask, what do they have in common? That is, what is the list of requirements in order to have a magnetically active object above the surface? A second thing that you need is some mechanism for loading plasma onto the magnetic field lines that are exterior to the object. That is, without the presence of the plasma, you wouldn't be able to see anything. So, if you like, the plasma is there to illuminate the presence of magnetic fields. And if you look at late-time stars, we know that we have this process that some people call evaporation. It's a very poor choice of words because there's no phase transition, but basically means you deposit energy in the corona. Heat conduction carries that energy down to the surface, deposits energy at the photospheric level or chromospheric level, energizing that plasma. And since the scale height of the gas goes roughly like the temperature, the gas down there expands and fills the plasma loops. So that's what solar physicists refer to as evaporation. Where does the plasma come from in pulsars? Well, pair production. You've got gammas that decay, producing pairs, electrons and positrons, and they're the ones that illuminate the magnetosphere. Giant gaseous planets, well, we have these wonderful example of Io, the Io Taurus, where it's the outgassing of material from one of the moons that plasma loads. And finally, you need some mechanism for energizing the plasma. So in late-type stars, we think it's the motions at the surface of the star. In pulsars, it's most likely rotation. It's hard to see what else it could be. Giant gaseous planets, we know that the solar wind in particular, has much to do with the energization of the magnetospheres of giant gaseous planets, and for that matter, of the terrestrial magnetosphere. Now, are there mechanisms that could operate in totally different circumstances? Things that, you know, other mechanisms for activity that don't have this list of requirements. Well, for example, could you imagine taking a late-type star that's just outside the magnetopause of an AP star? What would that object look like? What if you had a giant gaseous planet that's within the magnetosphere of an AP star? So in the first case, you have the interaction of a solar-type star, the magnetosphere of a solar-type star, with the magnetosphere of an AP star, where the mean field here is in thousands of Gauss, as opposed to tens of Gauss mean field for a star like the Sun. And in the second case, giant gaseous planet, imagine a Jupiter-like object sitting inside of the magnetosphere of an AP star, not an impossible situation, since we know that giant planets can be within the orbit, for example, of Venus to their companion star. Okay, getting back to the topic that that erase some discussion here, a dynamo versus activity saturation. And I just want to here make a point, which is, there's a quote from a paper, says the following, says, we expect stellar dynamos to eventually saturate at sufficiently high rotation rates, since at some point the back reaction of magnetic field on convection and differential rotation becomes appreciable. The point that I want to make is that that sentence conflates two different notions of saturation. So one sense of saturation has to do with what we talked about just earlier, which is the idea that I have a linear system, the dynamo, which eventually does saturate in the sense that the exponentially growing solutions of the linear system eventually saturate at some level, and that saturation presumably happens because of nonlinear effects of the kind that I discussed here, the back reaction of the magnetic field on whatever the fluid motions are. There's a different sense of saturation, which has to do with the fact that that I mentioned earlier, namely, that if I take a star like the Sun, it just turns time backwards. I know that for the Sun at its present age, and in fact for the past roughly 4 billion years, the activity level of the Sun roughly scaled like the square of its rotation rate, which means that since the Sun has been despinning since it started on the main sequence, means that the activity rate has actually dropped enormously. We have, for example, a solar type star, a G2 star in the solar neighborhood, which has a period of about 4 days, and it is a much brighter X-ray source than is the Sun. So the Sun presumably did the same thing. It started with a fairly rapid rotation rate on the order of less than a week, and ended up with a rotation rate of something of the order of a month. And the activity level dropped according to the scaling relation. However, we know when the Sun was very young, when it was a protostellar object, that the luminosity no longer correlated with the rotation rate. And that's a different kind of saturation. That is, as the rotation rate goes up and then recapitulates basically the early history of the Sun, we know that the activity level does not continue to increase as omega squared. At some point, it simply saturates. And that's a different saturation mechanism. It has nothing to do with the back reaction. There may be other things that happen. For example, it could be that the dynamo mode changes. So this is sort of what I think of as linear thinking. Right? It could be that the nonlinearities change at high rotation rates. It could be that there are yet other nonlinearities at a high rotation rate. Or it could be that there is a change in the geometry of where the emission regions are. Perhaps that is changing. For example, imagine that the surface is completely filled with flares and not the relatively quiescent loops that we saw earlier. Lee, you had a question?
No, I was just thinking, it seems to me there's like, the two things you're talking about, it always worried me about that you had certain magnetic field, right? You might saturate battery, you might do whatever, but then activity, in the sense that you're using it, actually requires some energy dissipation.
Right.
And it's not clear to me that that isn't yet another factor of saturation.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. All that is subsumed in right there. Right. I didn't mention disks. Right. Surely disks matter as far as the activity of these stars are. But you will talk about that, I think. So this is a subject of great complexity and actually also a lot of fun. And we'll hear about it at this meeting. Another question that I want to raise has to do with the dissipation of magnetic fields. If you go back to Parker's original paper. Of course, an essential process in the alpha-omega dynamo is turbulent dissipation of magnetic fields. And you could ask, for example, what is the role of plasma ejection? We know that stars eject plasma, winds, flares, coronal mass ejection, CMEs. And what role does the plasma ejection play in removing magnetic flux from the star? Do we actually have observational evidence? Do we know for sure that the magnetic flux is actually changed? It would be interesting to hear whether we actually have evidence, direct evidence, that this is actually happening. Does plasma ejection regulate the dynamo process in some way? There's been a debate in literature. Many of you are aware of the role of helicity in dynamo, magnetic helicity. And, of course, the crucial question is, what is the outer boundary condition for helicity? Should we think of it as a closed box, or does ejection of helicity, magnetic helicity, by the wind, for example, play an important role in the dynamo process? What about the dissipation of magnetic fields in the interior? So this is what is in Gene Parker's paper. He assumed that that fields are dissipated in the interior and that it works via turbulent dissipation. So there the question is, well, what is the experimental or computational evidence that this exists? And of course, the conundrum is that it's not all that easy to clearly separate field dissipation of this sort from field generation if you, for example, looking at an object that's fully nonlinear as a dynamo. How do you tell the difference? What's what here? What about fast reconnection? We know fast reconnection plays a very important role in low beta plasmas, for example, the solar corona. Fast reconnection is the only way that it can actually account, for example, for the timescales of solar flares. If reconnection were not fast, by fast I mean independent of the local transport properties in the plasma. If it were not fast, we simply would not be able to explain solar flares. Well, what about at high beta plasmas? Does it play a role? I think it's an open question. And finally is the obvious question. Okay, fields perhaps dissipate in the interior. Fields are ejected from the star. Which dominates? Are there other ways of getting rid of the field? And as I promised, I said I would talk about objects. So here I'm going to pick three objects. One of them has to do with a topic that, in fact, Lee Hartman, who just asked me a question before, is going to address, namely, why is it that young stars are so active? By young, I mean solar-type stars. They're very bright, they're highly variable, they're very hard sources, meaning the mean temperature, as determined by X-ray spectroscopy, is very high, in the tens of millions of degrees. And traditionally, it's been thought that it's solar activity, but there are complications. For example, these objects typically have disks, and it's hard to believe that there aren't interactions between the magnetic fields in the disk and the star itself. We have the saturation process that I already talked about. One of the attractive thing about this picture, that is thinking of it as a more complicated object than the sun, but still solar-like, is that it allows you to explain certain peculiarities in isotopic abundances, for example, of beryllium, calcium, aluminum, magnesium. And, of course, what's really fascinating for those interested in climate and the evolution of the young Earth is that by looking at these objects, we see, get a peek at what the solar system must have been like in the first half billion years. Very different than it is today. Now, what are some of the puzzles? Well, where are the seed magnetic fields from that started the whole thing? Are they dragged in by the disk from the interstellar medium? Are they generated in the star itself? What is going on? How does saturation of the sort that I discussed earlier work? How do the accretion disks dissipate? Where do they go? Another question has to do with the hot stars. These are very massive stars that I mentioned earlier have this interesting attribute that their X-ray luminosity scales with their bolometric luminosity. Now, the standard theory for explaining the connection between X-ray luminosity and bolometric luminosity for the hot stars is that we know that they have very powerful radiatively driven winds, that is the photon pressure from the star, the very bright UV sources, interact with the surrounding plasma and lifts the plasma out of the gravitational potential. So you don't have to appeal to any kind of magnetic waves, or any kind of waves for that matter at all, in order to explain the observed winds. On the other hand, and there's some beautiful work been done showing that radiatively driven winds are in fact unstable to, it turns out, acoustic modes that grow exponentially, shock eventually, lead to shocks, and the shocks lead, of course, then to hot plasma. So you might think, well, what's there to explain here? Well, that's where data comes in. This is data of a hot star, Gamma Cass. And these observations were taken by the X-ray Timing Explorer. So this is an instrument that is designed to measure the X-ray flux from point sources at very high time resolution. And what you see here is the light curve in the ultraviolet of the star together with the X-ray data, which is scattered all over the place. And I can tell you that this is not Poisson statistics. This source is fluctuating. And it's very hard to see how one of these objects fluctuates on the time scales that you see. It's really quite a remarkable observation. So the question of how it is that hot stars fluctuate to the extent they do in X-rays is raises the question of perhaps, in fact, there are magnetic fields in these stars, and perhaps the magnetic fields do have something to do with the observed X-ray emission. So it's not all just a radiatively driven wind that's unstable. And the final question I want to ask has to do with brown dwarfs. So brown dwarfs are the least massive stars. They are stars that have that are basically large versions of Jupiter, which nuclear burning is just on the verge of turning on. And the standard theory for stellar activity predicts that activity should, in fact, decrease significantly once the stars become fully convective. So if you look at very low-mass stars, if you look at stars that are well below a tenth of a solar mass, until fairly recently, recently means 5 years ago, there was essentially no evidence that these stars have any activity. Well, one thing to remember when somebody tells you like this is you always have to ask, well, how many stars did people actually know that existed of this sort? And the answer was very few. So most brown dwarfs have been, in fact, found within the last half decade. And once they're found as brown dwarfs, now you can go out and ask, are they X-ray active? That means you now point the telescope at them and sit with the telescope for long periods of time to actually push the detection threshold way down. And one of the interesting discoveries, as an example of it, is here is such an object, LP944. So Rob Rutledge knew where to point. He knew where to point because the star was known to be a brown dwarf. And here there's nothing. And then you look a bit later, and there's something. It's an X-ray source. It's a very bright source. And that's about all that we know. Yes?
In the pre-main sequence, it's thought that all the M stars are completely convective. So
right.
They measured magnetic fields.
Right.
So, you know, the issue about...
What about brown dwarfs?
Yeah, we now see accretion in brown dwarfs.
Okay. So the answer is yes. Okay.
They're just hotter.
Right. So the question, well, you notice what the question is. We know there's a corona, and so the interesting question is, what is the dynamo? What is the star really like? And there are many other questions, which I don't have time to talk about. We can talk about fractal fields. What's the cause of the high degree of spatial intermittency that we see on the surface of the sun? Are fossil fields ever relevant? In the 50s, people still argued about fossil fields. For the sun, hardly anybody now talks about it. I don't know anyone who thinks about fossil fields for the sun as an explanation for solar magnetic fields. But what about stars such as AP stars? Perhaps, is it an exception? Oh, perhaps there's an exception.
I introduced Douglas to you.
Oh, okay. All right, Douglas, you'll be up. We'll have an argument. I didn't talk about dividing lines. I mentioned that at the beginning, that once on the giant branch in the HR diagram, if you go redder than roughly the sun in spectral type, that it appears that activity, as defined by coronal activity, that is high temperature gas, seems to disappear. There's a question of whether or not there's a basal or minimum level of activity, a background, if you like, that's unrelated to magnetic activity. There are people who've suggested that such a background exists, and it may be related to the old version of coronal heating, going back to the 1940s, namely steepening of acoustic waves generated by the convection. Polar spots, I mentioned them just in passing. We know that some stars show polar spots. The sun never does. Why is that? I didn't talk about solar luminosity variations or stellar luminosity variations. We know that there's an anti-correlation between the solar constant and the level of magnetic activity. The sun is dimmest in the mean during solar maximum. And if you look at stars, I pose that as a question, but there's evidence that the opposite is true. So why is that?
And then there's a correlation between the radios and solar activity.
Right. So,
it's not as dim as in the mean at times of maximum activity.
Well, people have measured it. In fact, this Hank here.
It's only been measured in the.
Oh, yes, right, right.
Well, it's the other way around.
Right, right. So what you have is you have an explanation of the observed effect.
I'm saying the observed effect is the other way around in the plane of the activity. So if the total luminosity is in the opposite to the
right.
plane, how do you know about that?
We don't. We don't know. I mean, we've never been outside. I'm sorry?
Why did you say it?
Because I tried to be careful. And the solar constant, right, is what's measured in the ecliptic. Mm-hmm. And I said it varies. I didn't say the bolometric luminosity of the sun varied. Right?
It varies such that it's a maximum activity.
Which? The solar constant? No, I don't think so.
You said the reverse.
The sun relation.
The solar constant is maximum. I misspoke. Yes.
But statistically, most stars are observed nearly equator on anyway.
Right. Never mind.
Let us skip this page.
Yes. I mean, I think it's worthwhile to discuss this issue of exactly how magnetic fields, in fact, influence the solar constant. I mean, that's worthy of a session, I think. Okay, so what is my summary? First of all, if you look at the past 25 years, there's been a new field in which the ideas that solar astronomers have been thinking about for a much longer period have been applied to other stars. And the motivation, of course, was largely new generation of observations in the X-ray, in the UV. It turns out going back to the optical effect. So it's an exciting time, and we're at the point where, in fact, we're now faced with trying to explain what we see on the basis of the solar observations. Can we, in fact, do this? In the case of the sun, of course, in the meanwhile, they have not stood still. And one of the great, great discoveries of the last 25 years is, in fact, the fact that you can use helioseismology to look at the interior of the sun and actually say something constrained models. That is no longer the case that the interior rotation profile, for example, is a free parameter, that you can do anything that you like. It's not constrained. One of the points that I will make again is that the framework, the theoretical framework for solar activity that was developed a long time ago, basically seems to be still appropriate for discussing not only activity of the sun, but also of other stars. And as I've tried to point out in the questions that I asked, especially at the end, the number of new questions that the data pose is really much larger than the number of questions that were answered. So this is a growth industry for those of you who are thinking about this field. So with that, I'll end.
Well, thank you, Bob, for that superb introduction to all the questions, issues, and problems that we're going to be talking about. We have a bit of time for discussion, not too much, so I don't want to speak with you on lunch. Alexander is making his game.
Yes.
You posed a question, or your first puzzle,
yes.
Why linear dynamo approach is so successful in explaining obviously nonlinear phenomena? And I still remember in 1981, in comments on astrophysics, by the way, I suggested a possible answer to this question. And if I can formulate in one word, the answer is clock. Clock. But because we're in mathematical audience, I have to give some explanation to this. A clock is a fully, completely nonlinear system which operates on a limit cycle, using the French language of Poincaré. And that's because you have a limit cycle. You can easily mimic it by eigenfunction approach with a periodical frequency. In that sense, we're all on a red herring road. You know, using linear theory, I try to saturate to what do you sell it? Use some knobs, to do it. Mm-hmm. perhaps if we're so clever and powerful, we start from the clock and go down and try to understand all the symmetries, of course. But in the sense of frequencies, I think...
Let me offer the following comment to that. One of the results that I found most intriguing about the work that people like Nigel and Chris did and others did, on truncated systems, is that they behave very much like the way you describe. Okay, you can get them into limit cycle behavior, for example.
And then what's the others?
Right. No, there's a large group of people. I'm sorry that I didn't mention that. What I found fascinating is that as you increase the number of modes that you include, the simplicity of these systems disappears. And one of the things that the systems fall victim to is that all these very simple regularities go away. And so you have to wonder what happens. I knew that person would add. So you have to wonder what happens if you go to the fully nonlinear system, the PDE that we're actually all trying to model. Mike.
Well, I'm not sure I have a counterexample from dynamo theory, but certainly a counterexample from two-dimensional Boussinesq convection, where the simplest truncation is the Lorentz equations, which have very bizarre behavior, right, even for large frontal numbers, whereas the full system has much less bizarre behavior. In fact, it's extremely boring from a temporal point of view. So it isn't always the case that adding extra modes makes for more complexity.
Right. That's a great counterexample.
But I think another argument is that put in different languages, the Hopf bifurcation is extremely robust.
Right.
You mentioned the important problem of turbulent dissipation of magnetic fields, which, by the way, Parker, on the occasion of his Kyoto Prize, rated as the number one problem in this business. It seems to me there's an important distinction, though, between dissipation by spatial scattering, which leads to like the data effect we know and love from mean field electrodynamics, and dissipation by non-collisional exchange of momentum between electrons and ions, which is, in some sense, a true anomalous resistivity.
Right.
And the case you mentioned from MRX is the latter, which is not clear that's at all relevant for many of the cases we have to deal with in the sun. So I was wondering if you could perhaps amplify on that a bit.
Right. So... So what Pat is alluding to is that the MRX study at Princeton was aimed at trying to answer the question, can you see in a laboratory setting fast reconnection? And the difficulty is that in that experiment, what they actually see is that as you increase the collisionality of the plasma, you actually go to the Parker reconnection rate. That is, it's very clear that in that experiment, you go back to slow reconnection as the plasma becomes fully collisional. Okay, so your comment is quite right that in that case, that case is simply not relevant to the interior of the sun. Now, I'm actually asking a slightly different question, and that is usually when one talks about reconnection, it's usually discussed in the context of steady reconnection. So the original Parker model was steady. The Petrick model was steady. In fact, almost all essentially all analytic studies that I'm aware of refer to steady reconnection. Now, you can ask yourself, what examples do we have in either the laboratory setting or in the natural setting, that is, outside, in the outside world, that reconnection is ever steady? I think it's hard to think of a single example. So that raises the interesting question. The exclusion of using single fluid MHD for as a way of looking for fast reconnection is entirely based on the assumption that what you're looking for are steady solutions. So now you can ask, well, what if you allowed time-dependent solutions, intermittent solutions? Could you have fast reconnection then? That is, episodes of fast reconnection followed by periods of separated by periods of slow Parker-like reconnection. And I think the answer to that question, the jury is still out. There are simulations, which you're probably aware of, that show examples of fast reconnection episodes, bursts of fast reconnection, in a system, a computational system, that uses simply single fluid theory. So the obvious question is, could such a process take place in the interior of the sun? I don't know.
Time for a couple more projectiles.
Bob, in your summary, you concentrated on young stars and main sequence stars, but right. One could also mention that in late stages of stellar evolution, through core contraction, envelope expansion, conservation of angular momentum leads to strong differential rotation, and there could be a lot of interesting dynamos in those cases,
right.
For example.
Right, absolutely. Right, I that was one of the questions I left hanging when I talked about dividing lines, because dividing lines are all about exactly this issue. Yes, you're totally correct.
You mentioned in your question, open questions, how can we image a region of star spots in polar region?
Right.
But you know, in some sense, it's open question, what's the region of normal sunspots? It's amazing in some sense, I guess, how to produce from homogeneous magnetic field is beyond the rule.
Right. Totally agree.
You mentioned we could turn knobs from the sun, you know, to observe up. And my question is it possible to observe stellar activities on stars that are very close to the sun?
Yes. And, yes. Absolutely.
Can you measure also the magnetic flux actually on these stars?
No. Unfortunately, not. But there's been a wonderful work done at Mount Wilson, for example, addressing exactly this issue. And there, the wonderful thing is that the records are there over the appropriate time scale that you actually see changes in activity level based simply on ground-based optical data. And this has been Sally Bell-Yunis and her collaborators have played a key role in this. I think Lee was involved.
I think, but I can't remember anything.
Well, I think it's probably time now to adjourn for lunch. I'm very grateful to Bob. You set the scene. There will be three more introductions.